a Power Alert on this Sunday afternoon program, and I'd like to introduce at this time Mr. George King, who owns the Boundary Lodge on the Taylor Highway, and here is a real oil pioneer. And at this time, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. George King of the Boundary Lodge. George?
Well, yes, I'm George King. I, when you talk about yourself, I always sound like you're bragging. You have to show a certain modesty, I suppose, in these things. For the record, though, I, Captain Roy Jones and I were the first commercial pilots in Alaska. And I also was the first solo pilot in Alaska and also the first parachute jumper in Alaska. There have always been some misinformation on these things, because after I left Roy Jones, after I went into the interior in Fairbanks, I became a partner of Colonel Ben Ileson and Joe Crossan. Consequently, they called Ben the father of aviation. But it happened to be that Roy and I were in commercial operation in 1922, and Ben was in 1923, one year difference. But being that I was a partner of both these gentlemen, why, it was far from me to take anything away from Ben, you know. And Ben and Joe and I promoted what now is the Pan American Airways. We sat in Juan Tripp's office for 2 weeks in New York. Priester, their chief engineer, and Juan Tripp himself, and we sold the idea to them for the what now is Pan American. And Ben had made his flight across the North Pole with Sir Hubert Wilkins, or Captain George Wilkins, those days, and Sir Hubert now. And when he came back from Norway, why, Sherman Fairchild and Juan Tripp got a hold of him and made him executive vice president, and gave him a checkbook to buy out the two little or three little companies that were trying to fly in the interior. One was the Fairbanks Airplane Service, old Paul Lavery, that's the father of Bill Lavery, and Bennett Rotabaugh. Bennett was a flyer, and Rotabaugh was a railroad man, that's another company. And then Noel Ween, he came into the picture, and he sold out to Vic Ross, his name was. He retired or quit flying. And well, then Russ Merrill, Merrill Airport's named after Russ. He was lost in Cook's Inlet, I guess. Nobody ever found any of his records or anything. But anyhow, the Anchorage Air Transport, that is Merrill, and the Bennett Rotorbar Company and the Fairbanks Airplane Company were the three little companies that Ben bought up for Pan American. And he was executive vice president, and Joe was a chief pilot, and I was in the hospital in New York. I had crashed junkers, German junkers in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And when I came out of the hospital, being the junker people, they sent me over to Germany to get back on my feet again. And so then I got out of the hospital over there, and then I went ferrying junkers for, junkers we say in Germany, junkers. And I was ferrying ships to different parts of that country, Afghanistan, Persia, Iraq and Iran now, I guess. And then we promoted a flight to from Moscow to New York by way of Siberia and the Straits, Bering Straits to Nome and Fairbanks and Gulf and Tidewater. And Vito had made contact with me for $10,000 on the completion of the flight. So I started off from Moscow with a junker with an American Wasp motor in it, and I had a German co-pilot, Captain Schneibel, and a German mechanic, and so we flew to as far as Irkutsk, Lake Baikal, the Trans-Siberian Railroad. We got to Irkutsk, why, Ben was lost, and of course at North Cape, Siberia, and Joe and Joe Crossan and Harold Gillam, they were on the search party and found them on the wreck, Hamilton plane. And the oil that was there for me, the gas and oil that was there for me by Vito and Tidewater was used in the search, you see. And so then when we got to Irkutsk at Lake Baikal, we heard the news that they'd found Ben Borland's bodies, and so then I turned back and went back again. And my oil supply in Fairbanks was in the Ween hangar, the old hangar, and they'd had a fire and burned all that up too, and lost that too. So I only got as far as Baikal and went back to Germany again then. So just for the record, I also wanted to correct this. It was Roy Jones and I that were the first commercial pilots in Alaska in 1922. And Roy flew an old MF flying boat button in Pensacola, Florida. And a fellow named Jerry Smith was his mechanic. Not Jerry Jones of Pan American, but Jerry Smith. And then I joined him. I was down in Cornucopia, the mines at the time. And I bought in with Roy then. And we launched our MF in Lake Heckman back at Ketchikan on Revilla Island. In the meantime, we bought a little old ship here, Hall Scott Boeing thing with a single pontoon from Dr. Devine. Dr. Devine was a doctor here in Juneau. Had something to do with the Tycho Lodge, I believe. We bought that and we lost that too. Of course, we were under finance, had no money, and we went broke. So then I went up to the Fairbanks and joined forces with Eielson and Clausen as the result of what was the result of bringing Pan American to Alaska. Ben, meantime, previous to that, a year or two before, he'd been in New York and he had lived with Sherman Fairchild, lived in his apartments. I don't think Fairchild was married, if I remember right. He made him promise that when he got through with his flight with Sir Hubert Wilkins over the pole, that he would come back and take over operation in Alaska, which he did. Only last a short while, because the first ship, Nanook, was lost up there, frozen in at North Cape. The East Cape, that's right across from Prince of Wales, or Cape Prince of Wales, and North Cape. Borland was his mechanic, kind of a little side there, a lot of water over the dam, you know. Mrs. Borland is married to my younger brother, Captain King. He's the captain on the Alaska Freight Line that tows these ocean barges into Whittier and Seward and up in the Arctic. That's my younger brother. He's married to Mrs. Borland. Their son, that is Borland's son, Bill, is the chief pilot for Bob Reeves, the Aleutian Airways out of Anchorage. So there's all kind of shirt-tail relatives around the country. And my other brother, Leonard, younger than I, they're all younger than I, I'm the oldest. He has a store in Haines, Alaska, and also building a lodge over in Chilkat Lake. He's got a couple air-propelled boats and some other outboard equipment and lives there and doing very well. And I, myself, I'm in between time between the flying business, why I majored in geology. That was always my love. I'd been a miner and mined, and so I majored in geology. When I came back from the first war, I was a wounded man, and they gave me this vocational rehabilitation and sent me to the University of Washington. I wanted to, the irony of the whole thing when you look back, I wanted to study aeronautical engineering, and my coordinator said that I was crazy, there's no future in aviation. He said, you're a miner man, you take geology. So I took geology, 2.5 years there, and I came north, and then between them I studied geology at the University of Alaska. Those days it was known as the Agricultural College and School of Mines. And my professor was Dean Paddy, who now is Dr. Paddy, the president of the university. He and I see one another every once in a while and correspond. And I majored in geology, and I thought I was a pretty good geologist, although I never made no fortune at it. At this time, I can interject a little commercial in there for myself. Just before I left Bounty for here, I found a deposit of vermiculite, which is an altered biotite mica. It's just an ordinary biotite mica, but under heat it expands and becomes an insulation product. They call it vermiculite. Just kind of a funny thing about that. I met two engineers who had run down an old-timer story over in the 40-mile river of the vermiculite. I wasn't even acquainted with it. And they went over there and located this thing about 20 miles away. And he came to my place and asked me if I knew was there anything similar to that. And I said, no, I don't. But I know of some spots here that's got some hornblende and basic rocks. And I'll show you where it's at. You can go look. So they went down there and came back and said that it wasn't suitable. It wasn't what they were looking for. And when they left, why, I was cruising along the road one day. The road commissioners, Bureau of Public Roads, are fixing that road up between the Eagle Cutoff and the boundary there, and making a good job of it. And I was driving along one day, and it happened to be a nice sunny day, and I came by one of the black-looking deposits, and the sun was shining, and of course when it hit these flakes of mica, it reflected, and I got out to take a look at it, and here was this vermiculite. So I got busy and staked some claims and dug some holes, and the more I dug, the more interesting it became. And that's just before I left. There's snow there now. But I was going to contact the Sand Weatherman in Fairbanks and didn't. And I called two or three times, and those misconnections. George Cooper has what they call a ready mix. And I was going to contact Don Abel here or somebody, but I've been in touch with Holdsworth, the Commissioner of Mines, and I brought 25 pounds of samples out and five cigar box fulls and gave them to the university for their scientific rundown on it. They have to expansion and water content and specific gravity and all that stuff, you know. It looks very good, and I'm not only interested from the financial end of it, but with our statehood coming into being in Illinois, we're going to need something like that for payroll, so I'm doubly interested. I sure hope it turns out. I'm not for myself, but it's right on the darn road. You could transport it right to a big delta, and I think it's Holdsworth that told me that the Army uses this vermiculite in the aggregate. They use it in concrete and in plasters and steam lines and all that kind of stuff. So maybe we're starting a new venture there. It looks awful good in a way. But speaking of myself, between mining and flying, I first came north in 1910. I ran away from home. I came north, and in those days everything was horses. And so I graduated into a six-horse teamster, tote road, and everything was horses then. And I often think back about the difference in living conditions then. One day we got $175 a month for four horses and $225 a month for six horses. And found, they call it, that is your roadhouse bills and your expense money. We had no taxes of any kind except a school tax, I believe. No, we didn't even have that. We had a stick or medical dollar a month, in the way it was, for your hospitalization or something. And I think back, it's, we had more money than we have now. My grandfather, so there were no taxes of any kind. And your living expenses, even up in the frontier, that is the Atlin country and the cast iron country. And haircuts were 25 cents, and ham and eggs were 30 or 40 cents, and overhauls were $1. Levi Strauss overhauls, $1, and shoes were $2.50, $3, and we had stairs were getting $225 a month. So I think we were probably ahead of the game then. We didn't know it. I was a kid then, you know. I was 17. I was born in 1893, and this was 1910, but we 17-year-old were men, or we thought we were. We're holding down men's jobs. Now, I think this is probably wrong with our juvenile system. These 17-year-olds should go to work. They're playing around. That's where they get into mischief, I guess. We didn't have time to get into mischief. We had to work for a living. We didn't seem to mind. That was all in the game those days. But speaking of going back to the flying again, you don't know just how to describe this thing, because you almost feel that you're kind of bragging. But I was the first solo pilot in Alaska. Joe Crossan soloed me. Previous to that, I had taken some time with Eddie Hubbard. He was a famous old Boeing pilot, had a flying boat. Bill Boeing himself had taught himself to fly. Eddie was his pride and joy. And I had the first mail contact between Seattle and Victoria. And I used to make flights with Eddie on part of my training at that time, but I never soloed the boat until I came up with Roy Jones. I never soloed with Roy either. But when I got up north, I soloed with Joe Crossan. And then Noel Ween of the Ween Air, Alaska Airlines, gave me my acrobatics. Those days we always did acrobatic flying in spare time. Noel was a former flying circus man. I see Noel just before I left there. He's the vice president in charge of public relations. Sig Ween, his brother, is the president. Well, they got a flock of vice presidents. Noel is one of the vice presidents, public relations. And Noel, as I say, gave me my first acrobatics, or the only acrobatics I had those days. So when I drifted out of, got back in the mining field again, and drifted out of aviation altogether, by the state village where I've been under a rock pile somewhere, I suppose. But then when I got married, my wife looked upon, frowned upon this flying business. I'd bought a Waco plane, and made a few trips out to the 40 mile, but she was always worried every time I went anywhere, so I finally gave it up and left the plane on the field, at Weeks Field, and finally the vandals started to destroy it, and I sold it and got part of my money back out of it. No, I don't know what else to say in this pioneer business. I belong to the Yukon Order of Pioneers, and Dawson, this thing I have on the head, is that's the Yukon Order. And of course, belongs to Alaska Pioneers. There are two different orders. The Yukon Order is the oldest pioneer organization of all. They was started in the mouth of the 40 mile before the Dawson days started, and I don't remember the year, but it's 90, probably 90 or 92 along there. Of course, Dawson was discovered in 96. A lot of people think of Dawson as 98, but 98 is when the stampede took place. The actual discovery of gold was August 17th of 1896 in Dawson. And Jack McQuestion had a big trading post there at the mouth of the 40 mile, and complete tour to the everything, bar, restaurant, and dance hall girls and all that. In fact, the first girls that was in Dawson came from the 40 mile after the smack of the first girls. And that was 4 to 6 years before the Klondike was even struck. And I'm kind of proud to be a member of them because they're really almost exclusive. In fact, they turned me down about a half a dozen times because they got a regulation in their setup that you had to be 30 years on the Yukon watershed. And I had to convince them that the Tanana River flowed into the Yukon, so therefore it was the Yukon watershed. Otherwise, I wasn't eligible. So I belong to them. I'm very proud of them. Belong to the Fairbanks Igloo number 4, I guess we call ourselves. And it's the number 4 or number 6? Number 4, I guess it's number 6 here, isn't it? And we have wonderful meetings there, beautiful meetings there. We don't have a hall of our own. We have use the Eagles Hall. We have a little cocktail bar in there, too. And we have tremendous meetings. There must be 300 and 400 there. An auxiliary meets at the same time upstairs, and then after the business meeting, they all get together in social hours and have everything, smorgasbord and beer and milk and anything you want, ice cream, anything, and dance, and the show moving pictures and all that kind of stuff. You have a lot of fun talking over reminiscing. They all say man reminisces an old man, so I guess maybe that qualifies me. You get around and meet your old friend and you talk about the good old days, all the good old days, and it's a lot of fun reminiscing. I'm 66 years old now, or will be, this coming June. So there's lots of between age of 17 and age of 66. I've been complimented on my looks and everything, being my age. I get comments from both the fair sex and the men who look younger than that, which makes me feel pretty good, of course. But I don't know what I can say now, like this, going back to the Eielson affair. When Eielson and Borland were lost in the Arctic, I was in, well, I mentioned that before, didn't I? Yeah. I was on my flight, which afterwards was accomplished by Lindbergh, by the way. Lindbergh made that flight over the Hudson Bay and the Klavik and Barrow and then across the straits and down to Petropavlovsk, Kamchatka, and on through there to Trans-Siberian. And his flight, of course, brought world attention to. Our flight was supposed to be a fact finding, right? It wasn't publicity at all. In fact, Dick Lyman, he was the aviation editor of New York Times. He said to me, he said, if you go out and get killed, George, said, we'd make a story out of it. And they were interested in the heroics there. But we were on a fact-finding thing. We were trying to convince the world, the aviation world, that there's a future in the flying the great circle routes and the North Pole. Now we're practically accomplished, Scandinavian American and KLM. And now I guess Alaska Airlines and probably Pan American and all of them will be. But we were the fellows that saw the picture. I never tried to. This is the first time. This is my first time I ever spoke about it. Because I said before, I wrote Roy out in my back coat pocket. Now I wrote Roy a letter not long ago, and he corrected me on dates and stuff of our venture in '22. And of course, Joe and Ben are dead. But this last summer, in July, I believe it was, they dedicated a memorial to Ben Allison at the Allison Air Base. I had a little part in getting that name after Ben. The colonel at that time, the colonel in charge, was Colonel Wills. Full colonel, young man. They sent me a special invitation to attend the dedication. And Colonel Peck, Operation Colonel, young man, both top flyers. And so they treated us like we were royalty, I guess. I roomed with Captain Wilkins or Sir Hubert Wilkins. You know, I had a room together, and they waited on us like we were Prince Philip or something like that. And they assigned us a chauffeur, and my chauffeur was a big major. He turned me night and day everywhere. We took Fairbanks, back up the field into Fairbanks, and we'd go in and get a little Coca-Cola once in a while, and back would come again. And I was treated nice in my life. It made me feel good that they recognized you. I was on the reviewing stand there when Captain, or Sir Hubert, I always call him Captain George, Noel Ween, Governor Mike. I had dinner one day with Mike, and he had a driver, Lieutenant Trapp of the police, and I had Major York, and Wilkins had Major somebody else, and Colonel Peck and his wife were. So we had quite a time there, reminiscing again, too. I don't know what else I can add to it. Is anything you want to ask me, Joe?
Well, you look back in the old days there, why don't you tell us something about the navigation aids, if you had any, if you had to fly by the seat of your pants or what when you were flying.
Yes, I think we always said that also. We must see where pants. I had them up in the interior. Of course, in the coast here, going back to our flying boat, Roy and I, we lost the boat in Lake Heckman back of on Revilla Island, or Village of Gideon. The fish hatchery in there, in charge of a man by the name of Patching, an old man, and Roy and I went in there for, I don't know just why we didn't go in. I went to Belle Island Hot Springs first, and then up to Yes Bay to a cabin, and then we went to this lake. And, I took Mr. Patching out to another lake, after it was named after Patching, some lake that was hidden back in the mountains there, and he made that flight successful and come back to Heckman Lake, named after J.R. Heckman, one of the bankers and merchants of Ketchikan. And we took off, and it was in very hot, dead air, and we got 300-400 feet, and the lake was quite long, too, a couple of miles long, but this thing was waterlogged, and when he made a turn, we went into a stall. So we dove right into the lake, you know, clean it only by the tail. I was sitting on the co-pilot's side, and I came up through my plane, wires. I came up through, and Roy happened to be an excellent swimmer, one of the very best, a very athletic sort of fellow. And he came up on his side, and he didn't see me, so he went down again looking for me. And when I got up, I seen he wasn't there, and I started to go down for him, and up he popped again. And he said, "My gosh, I thought you was tangled up down there in the wreckage." And I said, "I've been up here already." And he said, "Well, I was too." So Patching and his crew, fishermen or hatchery men, they rode out, and this flying boat had a compartment, and of course the tail was sticking out of water, and she was floating by the tail. We towed her at the beach, and then we rigged up a tripod, and we finally got out on the beach, and still there. That was the ship. We took the motor. It was 150 horsepower Hispano-Suiza. We built a crate for that, and four of us packed it out 8 miles. And I strained my back, and I had to go to a chiropractor and get the vertebra straightened out after that. So we lost that, and that's when we bought this little plane from Dr. Devine. That didn't prove very good, and we lost that too. And of course, you had to judge your own weather, and you just didn't go when she was bad. But up in the interior, we did the similar thing. Oh, by the way, that old, famous old Jenny they talk about, Ben, local crowd had bought for him, Banker Stroker, and Dick Woods, and 10 or 12, and Bob Bloom, and those that purchased this thing for nothing, I don't know, a couple $1,000, I guess. And Ben done some stunt work around town there, and then he was awarded a contract by the government, Post Office Department. Coolidge was president at the time. In fact, I still have a letter from Coolidge to Arleson in my collection. After completed, they gave him a de Havilland, DH-4, they call him, and he made 10 flights to McGrath and back for $10,000 to prove that airplanes could fly the mail, see. And that plane, I was the last one to fly it. After Ben Hunt got into big time, Ben was the first aeronautical inspector for all of Pacific Coast and Alaska. Just one man. It was probably about 2,000 now, I guess. Just one man. He had California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Colorado, and so forth, and Alaska. And he issued us our licenses. Supposed to be examined for a pilot's license, but being we were all partners, we just issued our first transport. We were transport pilots. And up in the interior, why, of course, we had no fields, and we landed on gravel bars and caribou domes, and it was all wheel jobs, of course. Didn't have, well, we, afterwards, Joe and the fellow Med Young got killed over in Livengood. We built some of the first skis there, a fellow named Charlie Schick Carpenter, the first ski operations. And then we bought skis from Elliott Brothers in Sulukot, Ontario. We bought the, might say, the first ski-equipped planes. And we just landed wherever it was convenient, and especially in the wintertime, it wasn't too bad. And the only weather we got was the Army signals. They had signals at Wiseman and Nome. We'd check with them for weather. That was the only weather we had. Navigation, I came in from Livengood one night in the summertime. That was the last flight of the Jenny. I went over, Joe and I went over. Joe would fly in a Swallow 180 Hissel, and I would fly in a Jenny. We'd taken out the OX-5, which was originally engineered for 90 horsepower Curtis OX-5, and we took that out and put in 180 Hissel, twice the power. And we didn't help our speed any, but better on takeoffs and pack bigger loads. And of course, we had to engineer the balance of the ship. We had no stabilizers, no vertical or horizontal stabilizers, and so we had to rig what's called rigging. You had to turn buckles on your flying wires and your landing wires, and you adjusted your balance that way. Of course, 180 Hissel was a lot heavier than the Curtis and make her nose heavy. So we had to do all that rigging ourselves. We took the cabins off the upper wing, and we put drift wires on between the lower spar and the fuselage to take care of the thrust. Done very well. But I came from Livengood one night, midnight, and she quit me over college. I was about 4,000 feet, and I throttled back to my glide, and we were competitors, the Fairbanks Airplane Corporation. We were flying for Paul Lavery and the Bennett Odebaugh. We got to the point where we were jealous of one of those operations, and I wouldn't land in their field, and they wouldn't land our field. And so this old ship quit me, or the engine quit, and had long stacks, exhaust stacks alongside the fuselage, and they both flamed out. And I tried the magneto and tried the wobble pump, and nothing really happened, so I started looking for a place to sit down, and I couldn't get to my own field, so I went for the Bennett Odebaugh field. I missed that by 100 feet. I just got over the top of the willows and stuff, and she was stalling. The left wing went down, hit the ground, and she made three or four frog hops and up on her back. I had a belt on, of course, and I dropped down on my head. Didn't hurt that any. And Ralph Wayne, the brother of Noah, was killed afterwards in Nome with a couple of priests. He wanted to learn to fly, and he was a night watchman with the FE company, Fairbanks Exploration. He saw and heard me, so he came galloping out in his car. And then there was some honeymooners or something out in the end of the field there, holding hands or something. They came over, but I was all right. And, Joe had been down ahead of me. His ship was faster than mine. So when he looked in the sky and didn't see me, he jumped in the ship again and took off. And of course, he only had to go about half a mile. And there I was laying on my back of the plane. He had a big grin. Joe always had a big grin. So he said, "What happened?" And I said, "I don't know. Just I throttled back when she quit me." And the Hispanos were noted for, when they got cool, they quit you. They quit you now. They had no instruments. They had a tachometer and a compass and the oil pressure. And that is all, I guess, I remember. And so we, of course, she'd broken the left lower spar, and of course bent the tail out of shape, and the propeller was wrapped around the engine. Next day we towed her then from there to our field, because we were embarrassed. We didn't want to be on our enemy's field, so we towed her to our own field, and landing gear was all right. And next day we poured a little gasoline down the down the gas line from the gravity tank into the carburetor, and I got in the cockpit and switched on the contactor, threw the propeller over, and away she went. There was nothing wrong with it at all. She had just quit when she was cold, that's all. So that finished the Eielson Jenny, and it's at the university now in the museum. I took my picture with it here this winter. They head out to the Eielson dedication, showing the old and the new. The old Jenny was sitting alongside one of those 47s. It looked like a... Did you want to quit now?
Yes, I think our time has run out, George. And today's pioneer has been George King, owner of the Boundary Lodge on the Taylor, located on the Taylor Highway in Haines. Here's a pioneer. It is being brought to you by Oley's New York Tavern and Brownie's Package Store. And this man again interviewed today was George King of the Boundary Lodge.